You are listening to Anti-Institutional Extremism, Causes and Responses, a podcast series from the International Center for Counterterrorism. In our third podcast series, we discuss the issue of anti-institutional extremism. This series considers, what is anti-institutional extremism? What does anti-institutional extremism look like in North America and Europe today, and how can it be addressed?
Hello, I'm Dr. Joanna Cook, Editor-in-Chief and Senior Project Manager at ICCT. Welcome to our show today. It's a pleasure to be your host. In this series, we've already discussed the definition and evolution of anti-institutional extremism more generally, and also how researchers can more effectively research this phenomenon. We've also looked practically at what this movement looks like in North America. Today, we will focus on anti-institutional extremism in Europe, and we'll consider who is involved in this and how it is evolving. But first, I'd like to introduce our two excellent guest speakers today. Dr. Jelle van Buren is an associate professor at the Institute of Security and Global Affairs at Leiden University. His research concentrates on conspiracy narratives and political legitimacy, right-wing extremism, and terrorism and new eclectic protest movements. Dr. Julia Ebner is a senior research fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue in London and a postdoctoral fellow at Oxford University's Calava Center of Evolution and Human Sciences. She's also the author of several books, including Going Mainstream and Going Dark, that came out in 2023 and 2019, and also The Rage, which was released in 2017. Thank you so much for being with us here today. Jelle, perhaps we'll start with you. Can you describe what anti-institutional extremism looks like in Europe today?
If I focus on the Netherlands as a starter, for a longer time we saw the rise of what we called some kind of eclectic movements, sometimes also referred to as the salad bar ideologies or extremism, in which people pick and mix different extremist ideas and grievances to prepare their own extremist meal tailored towards their own taste. And for a long time we were discussing, is this left, is this right, is it independent, are these concerned citizens, or are they all? Well, finally, we are now working with something of a definition that tries to capture the essence of this movement, and that is the anti-institutional extremism, as it has been launched by the Dutch intelligence service, AIVD. This milieu, because I think milieu is the good description, it's not really a movement, it's not an organization, it's loosely connected. So this milieu, according to some estimates, it's some 100,000 people in the Netherlands who more or less subscribe to the idea that a malicious elite is oppressing the population, is trying to control the population. Is trying to maybe even murder a part of the population. So that is the broad extremist milieu of anti-institutional extremism, and that is what we are looking at this moment. However, if we look back, we already saw in 2010, 2012, we also saw some examples of sovereign citizens in the Netherlands. So it's not new, but it's more prominent and more visible these days.
And Julia, perhaps turning to you, I know you've had a lot of experience looking at countries such as the UK and Germany. Perhaps you could expand on this a little bit. Is what Jelle discussed in the Netherlands what we've also seen in countries like Germany and the UK?
Yes, absolutely. It mirrors a pattern, I would say, that we can see across different countries in Europe and, of course, also in North America. We've seen a very strong growth of, I would say salad bar ideologies, or what is also called mixed, unclear and unstable ideologies. As Jelle said, this eclectic, this idea of really having multiple ideological elements coming together and culminating in a kind of anti-democracy or anti-institutional extremism. And that is definitely something where, especially in the German context, this has been a big cause for concern in the security services and also for the government, where they actually introduced a new category called state delegitimizers, Staatsdelegitimierer, which is an entirely new phenomenon category that the Verfassungsschutz, the National Intelligence Agency, is now monitoring on a permanent basis, in addition to the more traditional spheres or the traditional extremist phenomena that they used to monitor, which was, of course, far-right Islamist extremist and far-left. And it's interesting because with the pandemic and with especially with the outbreak of COVID-19, we saw a strong growth of movements such as sovereign citizens in the German context, which are called Reichsbürger, which have a very strong, a historical, ideologically very specific direction in Germany, but which were combined with more modern or more newer conspiracy myths that were then tied to the COVID pandemic. And they kind of merged almost with the US movement of QAnon, where we saw a lot of overlaps in their narratives and in their conspiracy myths and even in the slogans they used. And there has been a very strong growth of this movement in Germany. In the UK, I think the landscape is slightly different, but we also see that since the outbreak of the pandemic, there was definitely a strong growth in QAnon-related conspiracy myth communities that would see the state and institutions, whether that's political democratic institutions or whether that's the established media institutions or even scientific institutions, as their key enemies. And they also share a lot of the traits with the U.S., conspiracy myth movements that were storming the U.S. Capitol on January the 6th. So I think it is a wider phenomenon that has now really reached a global scale and has also reached a scale where they do influence politics, where they actually are something that we should also watch from a perspective on the future of our democracies.
So there's a few terms that that you both use there, and I just want to explore those a little bit in relation to anti-institutional extremism. So you've defined the actors involved as a loosely connected group of actors, a milieu. Can you perhaps expand on this, Yella? Maybe I'll start with you here, but who is actually involved in this movement today?
A lot of different people and a lot of different groups. We try to make a distinction between let's say the people who are for political reasons or for economic reasons, because it's partly also a business model, are really selling the story. They are keeping the story alive. They are the more prominent people in this milieu. There are also a lot of people who want to believe the story that the elite and the government is bad and it is a malicious conspiracy. Because indeed, Corona was the perfect storm, more or less, in this development. A lot of people, at least in the Netherlands, have grievances against the system that are partly comprehensible, because there are problems in society. Democracy is not working for all of its citizens. So this story about a bad elite that is not caring for its population, but only caring for itself or some foreign entity or whatever, that makes up this loosely connected network. And there are four sub-narratives within the broader anti-institutional milieu, according to Dutch Intel. People concentrating on the satanic pedophiles that are part of the elite, so there we are in QAnon country. The sovereign citizens as a sub-narrative. We have now some 10 or 12,000 of them in the Netherlands, to our best knowledge, but it's always difficult to get a good estimation of numbers. There are also people who are more into the spiritual interpretation of the elites and the conspiracy, so the whole item of conspirituality is also on the agenda. So there are different milieus, of course, they overlap with each other, but somehow they are also distinct. It's a little bit of an overlap with the right extremist milieu, but that is not as dominant as maybe in other countries, such as the United States. So at the end, it's the context, the national context, that partly defines the exact nature and outlook of a phenomenon that indeed is visible throughout different countries.
And as Julia highlighted, I think most of our listeners would be quite familiar with the case of Germany and the Reichsbürger movement. So that was a particular group that had a hierarchical structure, a clear organization. In the case of the Netherlands, do you see the actors involved with that having a similar hierarchical structure, or are we talking about a lot of individuals drawn together by the same ideas and grievances?
Mostly a lot of individuals tied together. And the Reichsbürger also have a more historical narrative about the German state. We have some people in the Netherlands who also have such an historical explanation, but that's not the majority. So it's more a loose set of individuals with some organized groupings. I think we are talking in the Netherlands more about a societal problem and a societal drama, because people can get isolated, they stop paying their taxes. At the end of the day, you can think that rules are not applicable for you, but they do. So you will run into problems. And only a small fraction is really trying to create something of a parallel society with its own tribunals, with its own sheriffs, with this idea of citizens' arrest, and a narrative on self-defense. But we all know that these narratives on self-defense can easily a change into more offensive practices, but not as hierarchical and structured as in Germany.
And Julia, maybe if we can expand on that and provide a bit more context for our listeners, what makes the German case more unique in this regards? Is it the history of the movement already in the country? Is it, again, something slightly more new? How do we explain the distinct German context in this related to this particular movement?
The Reichsbürger movement in Germany is quite a specific movement because it's very much rooted in historical narratives, as Jelle suggested. So they don't believe in the Federal Republic of Germany. They still believe that the pre-World War II borders exist today and are in favor of something they would call still the German Reich. So they are very much, they're basically historical revisionists, and that's also why some of their narratives fit quite neatly within the wider far-right narrative, where they reject even the Holocaust, or they might believe in some other far-right glorification ideas of the pre-World War II era, which is why it has a historical dimension that is probably not that cannot be observed in other sovereign citizen movements across the world. But it has now been combined with more recent narratives that reject state institutions, and especially these ideas of the global elites, where it's now also much more tied to ideas about also the American elites, or to, in general, to anti-globalist ideas and to QAnon myths. So I think it's that very much that mosaic of different ideas that have been rooted in the history of the Reichsbürger movement, which has existed for several decades, and newer ideas that have really emerged only in the last few years. And in Germany, the numbers are quite shocking as well, because the Reichsbürger movement has gained a lot of new audiences and a lot of new members in recent years. So according to the security agencies, there are now, that's according to the 2022 statistics, but there are now over 23,000 people who would be part of that wider milieu of the Reichsbürger.
So we are talking about a fairly large population across the countries we've discussed. And perhaps, Julia, maybe we can expand a little bit more to Europe more generally. Do we also see these types of movements reflected in other countries besides the three we've just talked about? How widespread is this concern around Europe?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I would say, as Jelle said, they have different, they tailor their narratives to the regional context, but often they do use similar slogans, and especially QAnon is kind of a lowest common denominator for many of them, or at least for certain streams within the wider movement. Where we could see that during the COVID lockdowns, the anti-COVID protests that were happening across the world were really featuring very similar slogans, similar symbols and banners that mirrored what was happening in the US at the time, QAnon is, of course, originally a fringe ideology or a fringe conspiracy myth that came out of the US context. But that was then being very much imitated in other countries and tailored to the local context. So you could see even in New Zealand, there were protests happening in front of the New Zealand parliament, where there were clashes between the police and the protesters who were showing QAnon slogans on their banners. And this was quite similar in terms of the type of people who were there and the types of narratives that were being spread to the US Capitol riots, which we saw on January the 6th, 2021. And even before the US Capitol riots, we had something very similar in Germany, where there was an attempt to storm the German Reichstag. And again, with very similar slogans appearing there, very similar narratives. And even in Brazil, when Bolsonaro lost the election in 2022, there was, of course, also an attack on the Brazilian Congress. Again, of course, there were election fraud narratives that were also mirroring election fraud narratives we'd seen in the US context, but there were also other conspiracy myths that were very similar in their nature. So it is truly a global phenomenon, and this can definitely be observed in the run-up to elections or after election outcomes and protests that happened then, but also during crisis moments, with COVID being the best example, but also now the Ukraine war. And I'd imagine even now the events unfolding in the Middle East will also trigger a new wave of mobilization in the QAnon sphere, where this is very likely to continue to inspire this global mass movement to jump on the next big current affairs issue and to further develop their narratives.
And you've highlighted that there is a little bit of overlap with some of the far-right narratives that we've seen historically in Europe. But as academics, we always like to understand the ideology that underpins these types of movements and actors. Would you consider this related to the far right? Or historically, Yella, as you've said, are we also seeing elements or historical footprints also leading back to left-wing movements or other types of ideological motivations for individuals getting involved in this today?
Yes, indeed, because there's also a leftist tradition of trying to escape the system, trying to escape society, and or already build your own paradise and don't wait for some revolution effort to occur. So it's been part and parcel of a more leftish or radical left tradition. In Europe, you can even think about things like hippie communes, in which it's all love and peace and happiness outside society as far as possible. So it's not something that is only connected to one political affiliation. However, when you look inside these movements, there are, of course, huge differences between more left-leaning movements and the more right-leaning movements. But as an ideal, a prefigurative action, it's been called in the social movement literature, the basic idea is we don't want to live in this system for different reasons, and we already want to build our own ideal society as we speak. Sometimes that can lead to confrontations with the authorities, sometimes not, or almost none. So we have different manifestations. This idea of exodus, wanting to leave the system, as such does not have to be a threat or whatever. And maybe we can all imagine this longing for more freedom outside this machinery of modern society. So we really have to have a balanced view on this phenomenon.
In the last episode, we looked at the case of the U.S., and we know in the U.S., they have First Amendment rights, they have rights to protect freedom of speech, there's gun ownership rights, which makes the U.S. a somewhat distinct environment to Europe. But what do you think, from a European perspective, might impact or affect this movement in a more unique way than some of the factors we might see, again, in countries like the US?
I would say one of the big differences in the European context is, of course, the whole perceived censorship debate, because there have been more takedowns and content removals happening in Europe precisely because of that difference where freedom of speech is not seen as an unconditional right. It is also impacted by anti-hate speech legislation and by online safety or online safeguarding considerations. So there is a more nuanced view when it comes to what content should be taken down, whereas in the US, the US has, of course, had quite a high barrier to takedowns. So if it's not terrorist content, it would usually not be taken down. And even things like systematic disinformation about elections is now something that YouTube has decided to keep up on their platform because of the US context, because of this high priority on freedom of speech. Whereas in the European context, that is different. And that has fed into some, I mean, I'm not saying that it's not overall, probably it has a positive effect on limiting the extent to which disinformation and conspiracy myths can spread, but it has also fed into those conspiracy myths, and it has further accelerated this idea that, oh, the entire tech industry and the political institutions are conspiring against us and are trying to silence and shut up any kind of debate that is in opposition to them. So it has also had some counterproductive effects that are unique to the European context, I would say. And that is something where the European sovereign citizen movement and conspiracy myth movements have really thrived to some extent because of these perceived infringements on their freedom of speech rights. So even looking at hashtags like free speech, you can really see that there have been a lot of campaigns that have been run by QAnon conspiracy myth communities and by free speech warriors in Europe to further galvanize other people into becoming part of their movement. And it's a set of grievances that they could also tap into to recruit new audiences, because they would, of course, say that this is just legitimate criticism or skepticism about institutions. The same was true about during the height of COVID, there was a big concern about disinformation about the vaccines being spread. And they also felt that they weren't being heard, or the whole anti-vax community, which was, of course, not just purely a far-right phenomenon, but there were also far-left audiences and just traditional skeptics of the pharma industry who joined that conversation and who felt silenced or who felt that they were no longer part of the public debate. And that also led, in some cases, to a further radicalization towards anti-institutionalism and anti-government. Really distrust, which then could also lead into a more extreme direction.
And both of you have highlighted certain themes that tend to be coming through here, including the role of conspiracy theories, but also very specific movements like QAnon. I always associate QAnon with America, and I'm wondering if you see some of these conspiracy theories, QAnon in particular, as kind of American exports being taken up by European audiences and actors associated with this. Yella, I know you look at conspiracy theories quite a bit. Maybe we can start with you on this.
Yeah, we see QAnon. QAnon has arrived in the lowlands. It's being part of the narrative. And I think the main issue is, because it still is very much, it's an American story and narrative, but it's about children and it's about the abuse of children. That is at the core of the QAnon conspiracy. And children always have a prominent role in a lot of conspiracy theories. So we see something like the politicization of children. Children are, of course, the symbol of innocence and the symbol of vulnerability we have to protect. So everybody who's attacking children is the devil in capitals. So that's part of the political play that is at place. But there are also a lot of people with bad experiences when it comes to the authorities, child protection, etc. So there's a lot going on when it comes to children. Nowadays, QAnon is the symbol for this narrative, connected, of course, to the deep state. And maybe in 5 years, there's a different conspiracy narrative, but at its core, probably the children and protecting the children will be a very important element.
Leah, perhaps looking a bit more at your own work, and particularly around the issue of foreign influence, So we've just discussed the case of the U.S., and I wonder if you have anything else to discuss in relation to other U.S. exports to Europe that might be impacting this movement, or do we see other actors who are perhaps influencing this? Russia is one that immediately comes to mind, sitting right on the border of Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. There is, of course, a hybrid threat now from kind of also state actors who have an interest in destabilizing Europe, who have an interest in further strengthening narratives, extremist narratives, or polarizing ideas that are already causing tensions in Europe. And Russia is definitely, I would say the Kremlin is definitely one of those governments where we see that some of their state-led propaganda and their state media output has further accelerated the extent to which QAnon-related ideas could spread on social media and also anti-vax ideas and so on. It was interesting actually to analyze, for example, the content that the Russian state media outlets put out during COVID, where you could see that the Russian editions of Sputnik and RT, Russia Today, were actually, of course, very positive about vaccines because it was in Russia's interest to have their own population take the vaccines, whereas the German language editions and also the English language editions were hugely skeptical and were very much feeding into that that deep distrust in the pharma industry and in the vaccines. So there's this amplification effect. And I would agree, it's interesting that QAnon is, of course, an American phenomenon, or its origins are American. I actually joined QAnon for the first time in 2017, when it was still a very small fringe movement, where I joined some of their online channels, and there were just a few thousand members in those. And it was very much focused on US politics, on the idea that the Clinton family is running underground network of child abusers or child trafficking. And then I think one of the success recipes of QAnon has been that it's, of course, amassed a conspiracy myth that really has very skillfully combined different narratives, different conspiracy myths, old and new, linking up everything from the death of Princess Diana and conspiracy ideas about the royal family to the moon landing, which supposedly never happened, and NASA, and even aliens, and the Hollywood elites, and then it culminates in this idea that the global elites are trying to suppress the wider populations and are in fact Satanists who drink the blood of young children to stay young themselves. And that's the very extreme manifestation of QAnon, and there is a whole spectrum where some people don't believe in that. In this blood drinking part of the idea, but there's a whole spectrum, and I think they could pick up a lot of new audiences also in Europe with ideas about COVID, the origins of COVID, or the true purposes of the pandemic, as they would call it, and ideas of wider populations being the victims of elitist suppression, essentially. And that's a narrative that we've seen in various different conspiracy myths throughout history, really. And especially their strengthening has always been observable during times of crisis, where even in times of the plague in the 14th century or in times of the cholera, we had similar conspiracy myths emerge. And now we almost see that these QAnon myths are rhyming with what we've seen in the past. So during times of the plague, there was this idea that Jews had poisoned the wells. Or in times of cholera, there was the idea that circulated about doctors wanting to harvest organs. And it's something where perhaps we should have been better prepared for this whole new set of conspiracy myths that can really spread very, very quickly, especially when combined when combining this crisis mode that the global population is in, and new technologies and social media, and now of course also AI-based technologies, which will further accelerate the spread of conspiracy myths and disinformation. So I think it's something where we are perhaps even at an unprecedented stage of risks that conspiracy myths about institutions might really fundamentally destroy trust in democracy itself and in science and the media.
Now, both of you have used very specific language about some of the concerns related to this movement. We've used the terms risks, threats, but we've also talked about a spectrum of these as well. And I'm sure that, again, many of our listeners might have an aunt or an uncle that has believed in a conspiracy theory at some point in time, or, you know, it's not illegal to believe in conspiracy theories, for example, and though some of these concerns might be false information or misinformation, they do, perhaps, in some of these cases, fall under some protected rights or rights that or actions that should not necessarily be of great concern to the state. But when we're talking about risks or threats around this particular movement, what do we see as the concerns that you would highlight for law enforcement actors, for policymakers? Yella, maybe starting with the case of the Netherlands or some of the other countries you'd like to highlight, what exactly is the risk or the threat that we do see with this, particularly considering that the European Union is also very strong in terms of protecting freedoms like speech and so forth as well?
Well, I think it's very good to emphasize that there is something like free speech, and people are allowed to have funny IDs or strange IDs, or maybe IDs that are only strange in my eyes. So I think we really should not look at it as one big risk or danger or threat, because that can also lead to counter reactions that are not going to remedy the situation, but will make it even worse. So we have to take it serious, because yes, conspiracy narratives at the end of the day, from an empirical point of view, they are not correct. However, if you read through the lines, it's also about real problems and real grievances and real experiences of people. And that is something you have to address if you want to restore something of trust in society. And if you focus then more on risk and threat, there is a threat of violence. And in the Netherlands, we have some examples, but not really spectacular forms of violence. But of course, we have to be careful for that. However, we know how to deal with these kind of things. We have intelligence, we have law enforcement, we have a judicial system, you have the rule of law. So somehow we know how to deal with it. But in terms of longer term risk, something like undermining democratic order, a slow process in which we are not sure if there is something like a magic moment that democratic order really could collapse, because it's a very slow process of distrust, disinformation, real scandals, new crises in the world. And I think we're still looking for both a vision or a better understanding of this process and how to react to it. And at this moment, I think we are really still looking for a way of handling it. But building trust, rebuilding trust in societal relations and between governments and citizens, is one of the important pillars, one of the important forms of work that we have to do. But it will not be an easy task, because just like Julia also explained, conspiracy theories are something like an empty signifier. They have some recurring elements and structure, but you can project all your grievances or problems or scandals in this conspiracy narrative. So that's also part of the attraction. A lot of different people who maybe otherwise don't share the same ideas, but they share this idea of a malicious elite, a worldwide elite, is doing bad things to us. And that is very hard to counter.
And Julia, perhaps turning to you, we've already mentioned the Reichstag movement and some more physical threats that have come up in the case of Germany. But in your mind, when you're looking at this this milieu, this movement in Europe, in your mind, what does that threat consist of? Is it as Yella said, or would you expand on this or define it somewhat differently?
Yeah, no, I agree with most of what Yella said. I think what we have to be really careful about is, of course, not to to kind of finger pointing at everyone who does voice conspiracy myths, I think, are dangerous to different levels, on different levels or to different degrees. Of course, some of them are just a bit crazy and are not really dangerous in terms of inciting violence, dehumanizing outgroups, or in terms of undermining trust in democratic institutions. Take, for example, the Flat Earther movement. It's completely, to me, it's not really, I don't really understand why anyone would believe in it. And it's a very crazy idea that the Earth is in fact flat. But it's not something where we've seen many threats emerge from that conspiracy myth movement, for example. It's just something that's really not compatible with scientific foundations. But there are other ideas. And similarly, I guess, other myths have existed for a long time. Like, of course, the 9/11 truther, the 9/11 movement, but also ideas about Princess Diana's death. I think where it becomes dangerous is when conspiracy myths like that, or other conspiracy myths, are being channeled in a hateful direction, where they are translated into hatred towards minority groups or towards political representatives or towards democratic institutions. And I think in any case, when it translates into some form of hate, that can be really dangerous in terms of even inciting attacks, inciting hate crimes. And we've, of course, seen that happen. But there's also a separate threat that's not based on the imminent threat of kind of violence or terrorist attacks or hate crimes. That's a more long-term threat. And that is more about really undermining trust in institutions. And we've seen that in the context of Germany, what this can ultimately lead to. And of course, we've seen it in the US with the US Capitol riots. But in Germany, there was a plot by German Reichsbürger and also QAnon affiliated, or at least conspiracy theorists, who wanted to overthrow the German government. And even if it was very unlikely that this would be successful ultimately, it was still something that I would consider as quite dangerous, because it can inspire copycat attacks. It can cause a lot of terror. If it had been even remotely successful, it would have potentially caused a similar amount of anxiety and fear in both in the government, but also on the wider public level, to what we saw after the US Capitol riots. Where, of course, this has a major impact on politics and on even just public trust in institutions and levels of fear in the population. I think it can have a big effect on a societal level. And of course, also when these movements become bigger, in the US, there have been studies done by the University of Chicago, which showed that although there were just a few thousand rioters in the US Capitol riots, the movement has a much bigger ideological backing from millions of people. Over 10 million people do ideologically support the insurrectionist movement in the US. And most of the rioters were driven either by the Great Replacement conspiracy myth, so this idea that white populations are gradually being erased with non-whites, or the QAnon conspiracy myth. So those were the two main ideological pillars underlining the motivations of the people involved. And I do think that shows that conspiracy myths can really inspire actions against democracy, or attacks on democracy, or attacks on minority communities that make them quite dangerous. But of course, not everyone involved in conspiracy myth movements, or not everyone who believes in conspiracy myths, is necessarily leaning towards such more violent forms or such dangerous forms of mobilization.
Well, you both highlighted several of the risks that we see associated with this movement, but you've also, Yella, you highlighted one potential way that this could be addressed a little bit more effectively: rebuilding trust with citizens in government or between populations. And in our next episode, we are going to speak with some policymakers and practitioners in the US and in Europe about how they're more effectively trying to address this concern. But in your perspective, What are some of the ways in which this movement could be addressed more effectively in the European context? Yella, I know you've already mentioned one, so I'll perhaps start with Julia, and if you want to come in with any final points, please do.
I think one of the main things that we need to understand better is how, and Yella kind of touched on that, how different conspiracy myths fulfill different psychological purposes, because they always do. But what we didn't really get right, I think, during the pandemic, or now also with the Ukraine war being another major crisis, security crisis, and of course the events unfolding in the Middle East likewise, is how these current affairs things impact people on an individual level, and how entire demographic groups might be looking for some kind of conspiracy myth to fill that psychological purpose, or to address that psychological grievance, or to fill an information vacuum, and to give them a sense of perspective, or to explain something that is kind of lacking in their worldview. And I think that is something where we need more research being done, specifically during times of crisis, and then also to find ways of addressing these in a very targeted way. And the other dimension is that I think we need a lot more, we need to build better resilience in the populations by having better educational programs, both in the school settings, but also in settings that relate to not the digital natives, but rather the digital migrants, as I would call it, or the older populations, which have actually been found to be much more represented in movements like the QAnon movement, where the average age, according to some of the studies we did at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, was more 40 plus, for example. So there's also that sense that it's not something that is only concerning for our younger generations, but also for the older generations. But where I think we need to do a lot more at the intersection of digital literacy or digital competence and psychology, so that people understand better how they might be manipulated in an online group setting, or how their own psychology works individually, but also on a group level, on a societal level, when they are being exposed to disinformation content or to conspiracy myths. So it's not just about being able to distinguish credible sources from say disinformation content, but it's also about the psychological effects of this. And I think that intersection of psychology and digital competence is something we don't really have either in the national curricula or in other educational or awareness raising campaigns.
Yella, is there anything else you'd like to add in terms of how we can more effectively address this movement in Europe today?
Yeah, but it really is a challenge. And it starts always the question, do we already agree that we have to act against all these movements? Because maybe some of them, in my dissertation, I called it the canaries in the coal mine. They signal distrust in the post-political age. So it's also an important signaling function these movements have, and we have to take it serious. So I also think we still have to have a better grip on it. Julia is referring to the psychological needs that are also are reflected in these conspiracy theories. If I look at it, they have a dystopian future in all these conspiracy theories. But if you use that as a mirror, it also tells you something about the values who are apparently very important for people who believe in these narratives. And then it is about freedom and autonomy, and the right to live your life according to your own ideas. And I think these are all values we can subscribe to. So there is something, and not only conspiracy theorists are telling that, but also professors in political science, there are some serious problems with our old democratic orders. And we have to acknowledge that there are problems, and we have to work on it, because part of the explanation, in my view, is that maybe because there has been too little space for critical voices who are really critical towards the existing system, there has been something of a gap, and this gap has been filled by conspiracy narratives. So somehow you should emphasize the good parts of the critical stance and try to get away from all these conspiracy elements that are too out of touch with reality or have this potential for violence or undermining the democratic order. And that is something that we are in need of, a balanced approach, a balanced conversation. But that is not really our forte at this moment, unfortunately. So maybe that is what we from the academic world can contribute to this issue.
I think that's a really good point, Jelle, especially when it comes to this feeling that people have been taken, have had their powers taken away from them. I think even some of the mega trends like digitalization, globalization, have really accelerated that feeling of lack of power and not being able to do anything about one's economic or one's societal position or status. And that is, of course, something where conspiracy myths fill that or address that grievance and address precisely that. They give back this sense of power and advocacy. And I think that is something where perhaps we should indeed look at also this distribution of power in today's society and of course also ways of alternative ways of giving people a feeling of being in charge of their own lives and of their own destinies. I think that's a very good point.
Yeah, I agree with it, and maybe also it should challenge us to also understand conspiracy theories as a project of hope. People are hoping for an alternative. They are hoping that something alternative is possible, although the existing order always say, no, it's not possible, it's not legally possible, no, it's against agreements, no, we cannot do this, we cannot do that. And in fact, a conspiracy theory is telling you, if you get rid of this elite, an alternative world is possible. So it's also something of a project of hope. The big problem is that there are some actors who are misusing this whole to further their own political or economic agenda. And that is when we start to get worried. And we should start getting worried at that moment. But it's really a multifaceted phenomenon. We can also use it in a different way. I look at it to look for weak signals, because they tell us something of what is boiling in society. So that also can prepare us better of what is coming and what apparently are new tensions in society. For instance, the European digital identity card. It's a big issue. And again, this is about control by uncontrolled powers. And Brussels, of course, is always a good olden one in the conspiracy world. Also the digital currency, again, from Brussels. And this whole idea of transhumanism, the combination of human and technology, is also an element that really is important in these circles. And I think we are not really discussing all these issues from a critical perspective in a serious way in the mainstream media, mainstream politics, mainstream political parties. So there you can almost know that these will lead to new tensions, new actions around these developments. So we know what we can expect.
Jelle and Julia, thank you so much for speaking with us today about anti-institutional extremism in Europe. Don't forget to have a look at Jelle and Julia's recent articles in the special section on perspectives on terrorism. These include Rallying Around Empty Signifiers, Understanding and Defining Anti-Government Protest in the Netherlands, and The QAnon Security Threat, the Linguistic Fusion-Based Violence Risk Assessment. Julia's latest book, Going Mainstream, How Extremists Are Taking Over, is another must-read. Thank you so much again, and in our next episode, we'll look a little bit more at some of the specific strategies that government actors in Europe and the US are taking to battle and counter anti-institutional extremism.
This podcast episode was created by the International Center for Counterterrorism and is part of the series Anti-Institutional Extremism, Causes and Responses. You can find more episodes and information about our work on our website www.icct.nl. This show is available on any major podcast service, so please subscribe and spread the word.